Welcome to another episode of Tom's SciCast, and I'm your host, Dr. Tom Kennedy. Now today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects. Wait, I know, don't I always say they're my favorite subjects? I can't help myself, I just really like science. But today, we're going to talk about evolution, and specifically, we're going to talk about what causes a species to change over time. Now, before we talk about the mechanisms of evolution, that's just a fancy way of saying species change over time, let's get into some definitions of evolution. Wait, I just said one, didn't I? Species change over time. Of course, that's the easy one, right? But we can refine that definition to specifically stating that evolution is a change in allele frequencies in a population from one generation to the next. Wait, I know, that's complicated, isn't it? A change in allele frequencies in a population from one generation to the next. That statement has a lot of meaning. First of all, let's talk about an allele. You may not be familiar with that term, and that's okay. But an allele, that is just a different version of a gene. So if you go back to like Mendel's experiments on pea plants, remember? I know he had purple and white flowers. So we have this gene, which is a heritable feature. You get your genes from your parents. But there are different versions of those genes. So in the case of Mendel's pea flowers, those different versions are the purple flower and the white flower. That would be an allele, a purple allele or a white allele. And within a population, there could be many different alleles for each gene. So think about humans. Think about our blood type, right? We've got A, B, and O blood. So the different variations of that blood type are the A allele, the O allele, and the B allele. So you might find a scenario where the purple allele is in 9% of your flowers, and then the white allele is found in like 91% of your flowers. And imagine if you were to come back 50 years, multiple generations later, and the purple allele was now found in 50% of the population, and the white allele was in also 50% of the population, what you realize is that the purple allele became more abundant in the population, and the white allele became less abundant. That is evolution, right? That's kind of cool, because we had a change in the frequency of the purple allele. It went from 9% to 50%. That's evolution. And then I say in a population is a group of individuals that can freely interbreed with each other. I know, that's a biological definition of species. It's not the only definition of species, but I'll use it for right now. So we've got our population, they can all interbreed with each other. So that's the change in allele frequencies in a population, and because an individual does not evolve, your population does, but you would only change those allele frequencies from one generation to the next. So there it is, that's our evolution. So today, we're gonna focus on these mechanisms of evolution. What would cause a purple allele to become more abundant in a population over many generations? So there are basically four processes that can change these allele frequencies. The first one, the one we all know about, is natural selection. The second one is genetic drift. The third one is gene flow. And the fourth one is mutations. Now, mutations are interesting, right? Because that's your ultimate source of variation. All your variation in a population ultimately is the result of mutations. So our mechanisms of evolution, like natural selection, genetic drift, and gene flow, will act to make those mutations either kind of go away and become less common in a population, or if those mutations are beneficial, then natural selection might amplify that mutation over time, making it more and more common. So let's talk about mechanisms of evolution. And let's begin with what we know. I mean, that's, of course, most of us know about natural selection. Now, you can imagine you've got these green beetles and you've got these orange beetles. I know, it sounds like a cartoon we've seen on the internet before. And this cartoon, it shows these ravens and they're like, yum, green beetles, our favorite. So they're eating all the green beetles. So if you're a green beetle, you're doomed. So what happens is that over time, the orange beetles are left alone by the ravens. They're more likely to survive and pass on those genes to make the color orange. So over time, the population goes from being mostly green to mostly orange. Now remember, you've got a gene for beetle color in this fictional example here. And you've got two alleles, green and orange. And because the green ones are getting eaten by these ravens, we're changing the frequency of the green and the orange alleles over time, right? So as the ravens continue to pick off all of these green beetles, the orange ones become more abundant, the orange allele is becoming more abundant. What are we seeing? A change in allele frequencies in the population over time. So that's how natural selection works. So one way we could say this, let's do this technically here. Natural selection is a differential survival of individuals in a population. So of course, we know that Darwin in 1859 developed his theory of evolution by natural selection. Natural selection, this differential survival of individuals in a population, is what's causing this change over time. Now, Darwin realized that natural selection works because, well, there's variation among individuals in a population. In this case, we've got green and orange beetles. These are variations. So no two individuals are exactly alike most of the time. Next, these traits are heritable. So if you have an orange allele, you can potentially pass that to your next generation. Same with the green allele. So these traits are heritable. You know, there was a really good example of genetics and heritable traits on a TV show on HBO. Came out a few years ago. You may have heard of it. Game of Thrones. And I am sorry if I give anything away, but it's been out for a while now. There's kind of a statute of limitations, I guess. But in the Game of Thrones, it became clear that Joffrey was not the son of Robert Baratheon. Not at all. That he was clearly the son of Jaime and Cersei Lannister. And the way that Ned Stark figured that out was by looking at the hair color. Because the Baratheons all had black hair. The Lannisters all had blonde hair. So when Cersei was married to Robert Baratheon and they had children that did not have black hair, but had the recessive blonde hair, Ned Stark figured out who the real father was and called them out. And of course, that set off a lot of bad things that happened to them. But what I liked about Game of Thrones, they actually used genetics. It was kind of cool. So, not to get too sidetracked here, we know that there are variations within a population, orange and green beetles, or in humans, A, B, and O blood, and all the different genes that affect our skin color, eye color, hair color. Okay? These are heritable traits. Next, there are more individuals that are born each generation than can survive. So, you know, I see this a lot. During the summer, a lot of frogs will start to breed, and you might go up to a small pond, and that pond could be just loaded with tadpoles. Well, there's no way all of these tadpoles survive into adults. Within a few generations, we'd be covered in frogs and toads. But that does not happen. And the reason why is that not all individuals survive. And that over time, life and death are not completely random. I mean, it can be. I mean, you could have your pond randomly dry up. But you might have a tadpole that's a little bit better at dealing with low oxygen, heat, that might metamorphose into a froglet a little bit more quickly and therefore be able to leave water before it dries up. So these are some examples of how differences in a population might be important for evolution. So not everybody survives, and this life and death over the long haul, over time, is not completely random. So another really good example that I saw when I was traveling in the tropics, yeah, it's kind of cool. I got to go out and wander around the jungles at night of Central and South America with my camera, and I just took hundreds of photos wherever I went. And one of the more interesting animals I saw were these katydids. And in some cases, the katydid looked like a live leaf. In other cases, they looked like dead leaves. And I realized that there were all these different species of katydids that looked like leaves. Some of the ones that looked like dead leaves were really cool. I thought that the back end of their wing was totally chewed up. But what I realized is that that was an actual heritable pattern to make the wings look like a dead, decaying, chewed up leaf. It was so amazing seeing their wings look splotchy. I know, what a great scientific word, right? Splotchy. They were brown and yellow and black. They had veins in them like a leaf. And then, like I said, the back end of them looked like they were chewed up. So here's where natural selection works. You're trying to avoid a predator. And the more you can look like a leaf, a dead leaf, an alive leaf, or whatever, but the more you look like a leaf, the more you are likely to not get eaten by a bird or some other predator. You're avoiding predation. You're blending in. And these heritable features are passed on from one generation to the next. So over time, what happens is you accumulate these favorable traits. And of course, all these variations ultimately are the result of mutations. But natural selection is acting to accumulate these favorable traits in the population over time, right? So over time, these katydids evolve to look more and more and more like a leaf. That's evolution by natural selection. In addition to showing that species change over time by natural selection, Darwin also had two major concepts came out of his evolution by natural selection. Species are changing over time, right? Okay, that means that all modern organisms are related because they are descendants from ancestral species. Okay, and that natural selection, this is the mechanism of evolution. So as species are changing, of course we're changing traits, but we share traits in common with every other thing on this planet because we share common ancestry. I know, we share things in common with our dogs. We have hair, heart, lungs. Our bodies do almost everything the same as a dog does. Our hairs are made up of the same type of proteins. We have four limbs, one bone, two bone, lots of bones. You know, there's all kinds of similarities between you and the family pet, or a bird, or even a bacteria. I know, these single-celled prokaryotic cells. These single-celled, tiny, prokaryotic organisms, they don't even have a cell nucleus or mitochondria, yet we share hundreds of genes in common with the bacteria. Why? Common ancestry. And that was one of Darwin's very important points because it explains both the unity and the diversity of life. Today, we have millions of different types of species on this planet because of natural selection. Species are changing over time. But because we share common ancestry, we have many features in common. Now, before I go on and continue our discussion on natural selection, just a couple things here. Natural selection operates on the individual. Okay? It's the individual that survives. It's the individual that survives and reproduces and passes on its genes to the next generation. So natural selection is acting on the individual most of the time. And the next one is populations are the smallest unit of evolution. An individual cannot evolve. The reason why you can't evolve, well, is because you're not changing the frequency of whatever alleles are that you have, right? So if we define evolution as a change in allele frequencies in a population, well, you're not changing the alleles inside of you, so you can't evolve. However, you can acclimate to your environment, which is the subject of a whole nother podcast. Now let's get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of natural selection. Now that we have defined evolution, we've defined natural selection, we can actually divide or subdivide natural selection into different types, like directional selection, stabilizing selection, disruptive selection, balancing selection, then there's this really weird one. Sexual selection. And is it really natural selection? Or should it be considered differently? I don't know. I'll let you decide that one. But let's begin with some of these different subdivisions of natural selection, beginning with directional selection. And in fact, with directional selection, you know, that's what we typically think of when we're thinking of evolution by natural selection. But directional selection is a change in the average value of a trait in one direction. So if your average value of your height, if you continually evolve to grow taller, that would be an example of directional selection. A cheetah evolving to be faster, that would be another example. Or I'm looking more like a leaf, or I'm becoming resistant to disease, to a specific type of disease. These are all examples of directional selection. And we've seen this in nature. You know, every now and then, really bad storms come through, and it can drop temperatures way below average. And a lot of animals, including birds, might not be ready for that. So you can imagine you've got these birds like a swallow. And these swallows, they migrate up from Central and South America in the early spring. And the reason why they get here early is they're timing their migrations with spring when there's lots of insects and things are starting to warm up. But every now and then a freak storm might come through and with freezing temperatures. And in fact, this is exactly what happened to the cliff swallow. A few years ago, there was a massive storm and it caused a high mortality in these cliff swallows. And like over 50% of these cliff swallows died in this region with this bad weather. However, this is the important part. The deaths were not random. The larger birds were more likely to survive the extreme cold. So what happened after this cold front? The average population of cliff swallows increased in size. Interesting, isn't it? So that's an example of directional selection. Now, this story will probably get quite complicated because cliff swallows can't evolve to become larger and larger and larger and larger and larger because they would have to completely change the way they feed, how they fly, and how they nest. So there's other types of selection that would keep them from continually becoming larger and larger and larger. But for these few years, we had directional selection on them to become larger as an adaptation against severe weather. In addition to extreme bad weather, like a cold front coming through, our world is rapidly warming. Global climate change. I know we call it global climate change, but the reality is our world is getting warmer and all life is going to have to adapt to a warmer environment, to this climate change. So climate change is putting on strong directional selection onto many things. Out here in the West, we're in a mega drought. So you can imagine that any plant that has any adaptation or any ability to survive hotter, drier environments, that's going to be selected for. And the same goes for animals. Any animal that can survive a warmer, drier environment is more likely to survive and pass on those sets of genes onto the next generation. So out here in the West, our warmer, drier environments is causing species to adapt. Now, here's a problem. not everything can adapt quickly to a changing environment. The ability to adapt depends on how fast your environment is changing. What's your generation time? If your generation time is 30 years and your climate is changing on year-to-year basis, that's hard to adapt to. Also, the genetic variation present, that's also called heterozygosity. I know, heterozygosity is a complex word, but what it means is how many different alleles are in the population. So if you don't have a lot of genetic variability to begin with, you can't really adapt. There's nothing to work on. There's not a lot of variation in that population for natural selection to operate on. So if you don't have any alleles that allow you to survive in a warmer or drier environment, you can wipe out that entire population. So there you have it. So our response to climate change and this very strong directional selection, not every species will be able to adapt as well as others. And if it's extreme enough, nothing can adapt. Let's go to our next type of selection. And this, of course, is stabilizing selection. Most of us don't really think about stabilizing selection as a type of evolution, because what it does is it reduces the variation in a trait. I know. So it selects for the middle, right? It selects against extremes, and it selects for the intermediates. And believe it or not, stabilizing selection is common in nature. We can go back to our cliff swallows. Okay, we had a bad storm. Survival was not random. The larger individuals survived. But those larger individuals might not be as an agile of a flyer as a smaller individual. What that means is it might be harder for it to catch insects. So natural selection would return that population back to its intermediate size over several generations. That's why we don't see cliff swallows getting larger and larger and larger, even though we continually have extreme weather. Human birth weight, that's another one, the stabilizing selection. If a baby is born too small, so it's under the ideal body weight, then it has a higher chance of mortality, meaning it's less likely to survive. However, if the baby is too large, guess what? That's not good either for the baby. It's also not good for the mom. And if you hurt the mom or cause the mom to die during childbirth because the baby's too large, then the baby is also more likely to die. So there's an optimum birth weight of just under 8 pounds in human babies. So that's another example of stabilizing selection. And then we also see it in clutch size. You know, how many eggs does a bird lay? Well, if you lay a lot of eggs, great, you got a lot of offspring. You have to feed them. If you have a time period where there's not a lot of insects, most of them might die. And it also takes a lot of energy for the birds to lay these eggs. So there's this optimum number of eggs that birds will lay based on the energy requirements to raise those offspring. And one of my favorite examples of stabilizing selection are horseshoe crabs. If you go to the Gulf Coast or the Atlantic Coast in springtime, like May, and you go on a high tide, you're gonna see these incredibly prehistoric looking animals coming up onto the beach. They have this long tail, they've got this carapace covering them. These, of course, are the horseshoe crabs. They're not really a crab. And in fact, they're not even a crustacean. They are distantly related to arachnids. You know, animals like spiders and scorpions. I know, it's pretty wild to think that a horseshoe crab is more closely related to spiders than it is to crabs, but they are. And these animals have not changed in 450 million years. It's like they got their body plan right way back, I think in the Ordovician of the Paleozoic, like over 200 million years before a dinosaur walked on the Earth, 75 million years before the first tetrapod, right? The first vertebrate came onto land. There were horseshoe crabs, and they were mating and laying their eggs in the surf, and they have remained unchanged in over 450 million years. That is an amazing feat of stabilizing selection on these animals. Now, I'm sure some aspects of their physiology has changed in that time, like their immune system and stuff like that, but much of their physical appearance remains the same. Okay, so with a natural selection, we've seen directional selection and stabilizing selection. The next is disruptive selection. Now, unlike stabilizing selection, disruptive selection, it does the exact opposite. It increases the amount of variation in a trait. It's selecting against the average. It's favoring the extremes. And of course, the extreme in the phenotypes. Some people also call this diversifying selection. And what this does is it leads to populations divided into two distinct groups. Here's an example. In Africa, there's a finch called the black-bellied seedcracker, and it has a polymorphism. There's two different morphs in the population. So these black-bellied seedcrackers, what they have is a small build and a large build version. Small bill, large bill, what do you think they're doing? They're eating different types of seeds. And we know that the bill size is not correlated with sex. It does not depend on whether or not you're a male or a female. Now, of course, the black-bellied seedcrack is not the only example we have. If you go to the coast in Florida, I know, here we go, we're going back to Florida again. I know, I like Florida. It's one of my favorite places. But on the coast, there is this small mouse. Some people call it the beach mouse. I think it's Paramiscus, it's the genus. Now, some forms are white and some forms are brown. So we have a polymorphism. We've got two different morphs. I guess you could call that a bimorphism, but poly just means many. So here's how this works. You're either brown or you're white. And why is that? Well, if you're white and you're on the beach, great. You avoid predation because you kind of blend in with the sand. If you're brown and you're just behind the sand dunes and like the pine flatwoods, well, you're brown, so you mix in with the bottom of the forest. So you blend in with all the different types of grasses and the undergrowth. Now, you could imagine if you're grayish, kind of in between brown and white, you may not fit in the forest, in the undergrowth, and you may not fit in on the beach. So the two different polymorphisms are maintained. Now, of course, this is really important for something called sympatric speciation. Now, sympatric speciation, that's something I'll get to later, but the idea here is you can actually have speciation within a population where there's no physical separation. And this is why some people get really excited about disruptive selection. And I'll talk more about sympatric speciation in a later podcast. So now we've covered directional selection, stabilizing selection, disruptive selection, and now let's talk about the last type, balancing selection. This one's interesting. I like this one because it's a process and it maintains multiple alleles in a population. So it's going to maintain this higher rates of heterozygosity. Now, heterozygosity means we're maintaining lots of different alleles. Homozygosity means we have few alleles. So just think about humans once again. If everybody has a blood, right? There's no variation. You are homozygous. But if there's A, B, and O blood, then we have heterozygosity. Okay? So balancing selection works. You might have a heterozygous individual. Might have higher fitness than a homozygous individual. We have good examples of that. Or there is a balance among different types of alleles, or certain alleles are favored based on their frequency. Let's take a closer look. We've got two common forms of balancing selection. We've got heterozygote advantage, meaning the more different types of alleles you have, the more likely you are to be fit to your environment. And we have another one called frequency-dependent selection. Frequency-dependent selection. I know that sounds like such a mouthful, right? But let's take a look at frequency-dependent selection. I've got a couple good examples for us. In Africa, they've got some really big lakes, right? Lake Tanganyika, Lake Victoria. And in these lakes, they're just full of these different types of cichlids. Cichlids are a family of fish, and they are amongst the most diverse of the freshwater fish. And one of the reasons why is they have rapidly evolved to fill a lot of different niches. So one of these is a scale-eating cichlid. I know, a scale-eating cichlid, that sounds really weird. But what this fish does is it's a kind of a parasitic predator. I know that. I just made that up. It sounds kind of weird. But this small cichlid is found in Lake Tanganyika in Africa. And what it does, scale-eating cichlid, it eats scales. It eats the scales of other fish. Scale parasite, right? And it comes in two morphs. And it's based on the shape of its mouth. So some individuals, the mouth is kind of curved off to the left. And in others, it's curved off to the right. So if your mouth is twisted to the right, you're eating scales from the left side of your victim. On the other morph, if your mouth is twisted to the left, then you're eating scales on the right side of your victim. So think about it this way. You're eating the scales off of other fish. What you don't want to do is kill that other fish. You want to eat some scales, move on to the next one, eat some more scales. If you kill your victim, it won't grow its scales back and you can no longer eat off of it. So what this means is that if you have a morph, let's say a right-shaped mouth morph, your mouth is twisted off to your right side. If that morph becomes too common in a population, that means you're taking all the scales off these fish on the left side, which means if you're doing it too frequently, then you might cause those fish to die and you lose your food source. So here's what happens. As that frequency of the right mouth fish becomes higher and higher and higher, its fitness goes down, right? So you start to select against the right mouth morphs and for the left mouth morphs, okay? So over time, the number of right mouth morphs, that's a mouthful, isn't it? Right mouth morphs of these fish that eat off the left side, basically, their frequency goes down and the frequency of the other one goes up. Okay, now we've got these left mouth morphs. And as their frequency increases, guess what? It becomes less and less and less advantageous. So then it goes down. So over time, we maintain a balance, balancing selection, right? Of the right or the left morph fish. So it's frequency dependent. As they become more and more common, they begin to be selected against, and the rare forms are selected for. And then it switches. You know, your left becomes more common, the right becomes more rare. And this goes back and forth over and over and over again. So we have a balancing of the selection between the two morphs, and the individual morph, whether it's selected for or against, depends on its frequency. So if you become too frequent in a population, you are selected against, and as you become more rare, you are selected for, hence frequency-dependent selection. Pretty cool, isn't that? Now, we don't have to go to Africa to see balancing selection. We can see it right here in the United States, or at least in the southern United States, at least in the southeast United States. There's a small fish. It's called a mosquito fish. And for those of you that want to know its scientific name, it's called Gambusia Holbrook guy. Now out here in the West, we have its cousin, Gambusia affinis, and I can barely tell the two apart. But I can tell you that Holbrook guy has something kind of cool. About 5% of the population, of the males anyways, are a black morph. They look like a Dalmatian. They're kind of whitish with these black spots all over them. So they, like I said, they look kind of like a Dalmatian, and they occur in about 5% of the population. Now, they are a little bit larger and a little bit more aggressive than the other males, okay? So here's what happens. They're more aggressive, they tend to mate more often, but as they become more abundant in the population, they begin to damage the females. So then they're selected against, right? And as they're selected against, their population goes down. And then when they become rare, they are a little bit more aggressive at mating, their populations will increase. So over time, we have this frequency-dependent selection on these black morphs of these Gambusias, Gambusia holbrookii, the eastern mosquito fish. Now, let's talk about the other type of balancing selection. This is called heterozygote advantage. And in this case, we're going to maintain heterozygosity in the population. Or think about it this way. We're going to try to maintain many different types of alleles, or at least two or more alleles in a population. And a very good example of this one occurs in humans, at least in Africa. And that is the sickle cell trait. So I'm going to talk about malaria, sickle cell disease, and heterozygote advantage. But let's start with some background information first. Now, sickle cell disease, this is an inherited blood disorder. And what it does is it alters the shape of the red blood cells, and it reduces their ability to carry oxygen. And if you have the full-blown disease, which means you are a carrier of both traits, you are homozygous, this can cause pain, swelling, infections, it can reduce life expectancy, it can cause all kinds of problems. Now, if you're heterozygous, you've got one copy of the normal gene, and you've got another copy for the sickle cell disease, you probably won't show many symptoms, maybe only mild. But if you're homozygous for this disease, then you make all of the deformed hemoglobin. So if you become oxygen starved or dehydrated, then your red blood cells can collapse into this sickle shape and you have a flare-up. Now you may be wondering, and rightly so, why in the world would we carry a mutation that causes such problems? And how in the world can a heterozygote be an advantage here? This is where malaria comes in. For the history of humanity, malaria has probably killed more people than any single disease in the world and in the history of our people. Yes, more people have died of diarrhea, but I know that's awful because diarrhea can dehydrate you within like 24 hours. But the difference here is lots of things, lots of different parasites can cause diarrhea versus malaria is basically one disease. And it's a blood disease. It's passed on by mosquitoes, and the malaria parasite infects your blood. So the sickle cell trait actually helps give some type of resistance to malaria. So if you're heterozygous, guess what? You have some resistance to malaria. And I mean, this is a disease. It infects like 220 million people each year. And about 450,000 to a million die each year from it. And, you know, just from 1900 to 1950, like 100 million people have died of malaria. And each year, the world spends about $3.1 billion on malaria control by trying to eradicate mosquitoes that carry them. So this is a big deal, right? And this is why there's a heterozygote advantage with the sickle cell trait. Because if you're heterozygous, then you have resistance to malaria, or at least some resistance to malaria. Now, here's why it's also balancing selection. you have to balance the trait. If it becomes too common in your population, then more and more people have full-blown sickle cell disease, and that's bad. And if it's rare, well, guess what? If it's rare, then not enough people have resistance to malaria, and so it would increase. So it's balanced, and you have to balance a rate of malarial infections to the frequency of the sickle cell trait in your population so that not too many people get the full-blown disease that are homozygous for this. So that's one of our examples of balancing selection in humans. Now, of course, over here in the United States and North America, we don't have malaria. We actually eradicated it. So in this case, because it's no longer the environment, the trait has no advantage anymore. So there you have it. Those are the four different modes or subdivisions of natural selection. You've got directional selection, stabilizing selection, disruptive selection, and balancing selection. Now, I'm gonna switch gears, and we're gonna talk about sexual selection. I guess it's adaptive, so it would be a type of natural selection, but it's only adaptive in the fact that you're trying to pass your genes on to the next generation. So sexual selection, this is a type of natural selection where one sex chooses a specific trait of the other sex. And of course, whenever we think about sexual selection, think about birds like a peacock. Have you ever seen a male peacock? They have these enormous tail feathers. Their neck feathers are this bright, bright blue. They've got these little head combs on them. I mean, these birds are incredibly gaudy. And clearly, the female is choosing these incredibly brightly colored feathers. And why is she doing that? Okay, well, that would be an example of sexual selection. A peacock. And we see lots of examples of sexual selection throughout the animal kingdom. Now, one thing that we often don't hear much about is the origins of two sexes. I mean, why have two sexes? If you're a bacteria and you're ready to reproduce, times are good, you copy your DNA, you have binary fission, voila, you've got two daughter cells that are genetically identical, and there you go. And even eukaryotes can reproduce by mitosis. You just copy your DNA, go through mitosis, you've got two daughter cells. But sexual reproduction, that's different. It's a little bit different, right? You gotta go find a mate. You gotta find somebody else. And it has to be the right mating type. So you have to have a male and a female. And the definition of sexual reproduction is when you combine two gametes to form a new organism. So a sperm and an egg combine, each of those gametes carries a full copy of a genome. That's why we say we've got 46 chromosomes, right? And we have two copies. We've got one copy, 23 chromosomes from mom. We've got a second copy, 23 chromosomes from dad. So we have 46 total, right? We're diploid. We got two copies of our genome. And we are a result of those two genomes coming together to form a new organism. So why would you do that? Why would you have to go out and split the number of individuals that you can reproduce with in half? Well, that's sexual reproduction. We understand quite well how it maintains itself and the importance of it today. But one of the reasons why we think it got started is the mitochondria did it. I know, the mitochondria, they're so important. They're responsible for cellular respiration, suicide, you know, that programmed cell death called apoptosis. They're also involved with probably the origins of sexual reproduction and the two sexes. You see, I told you that we've got two copies of our genome. Now, mitochondria are the site of cellular respiration. They're using oxygen. Well, I mean, as they're using oxygen, that can be kind of bad. Oxygen's really reactive. it can produce free radicals. These things can damage proteins, membranes, and your DNA. So, if I can have two copies of my genome, and one copy becomes damaged, or at least one gene becomes damaged, I've got a backup on the other chromosome. So the idea here is that by having two genomes, I'm less likely to damage one crucial gene that would kill the cell and take the mitochondria out with it. Now that's the origin of sexual reproduction. You've got to combine these two gametes into one organism. Now why have two sexes? So let me ask you this. Where do you get your mitochondria from? Your mom, right? And in fact, the vast majority of the time, as far as we know, in the animal kingdom, and plants too, you get your mitochondria from the female gamete. It's large, has all the cytoplasm, all the organelles, all the mitochondria. Mitochondria were once free-living bacteria that reproduce asexually. So if you're getting all your mitochondria from your mom, they are clones of each other, so they're not necessarily competing with each other. If you combine two gametes that had different mitochondria, then those mitochondria would be of different populations, and they would possibly compete with each other for resources within the cell. So, to get around that, you only inherit mitochondria from one of the two individuals needed for sexual reproduction, and in our world, we define that as the female. So there you have it. The mitochondria did it. The mitochondria were most likely involved with the origins of sexual reproduction and two sexes. So here we are, 1 billion years later, maybe 2 billion years after the origins of sexual reproduction and two sexes, might even be longer than 2 billion years. And we see that the different sexes are choosing different traits. And one thing that we often see in the animal kingdom is that males are more ornamented than the females. I mean, just think about a peacock. And there's several reasons why we think this is. One has to do with energetics. It takes a lot of energy, or a lot more energy, to make an egg than a sperm. That's why many animals produce, the females produce far fewer eggs, and the males produce far more sperm. And most of us are more familiar with a group of organisms called the amniotes. We are tetrapods, you know, vertebrates with four limbs. You know, you got four limbs, hence the word tetrapod. But think birds, reptiles, and mammals. We all have internal reproduction, and we have eggs at some point. And the idea here is that an amniote evolved about 310 million years ago as a response to a drier environment. So birds and reptiles and mammals are amniotes. And this is where we see a lot of the ornamentation, especially in birds. And the idea here with the theory of energetics, think about a bird egg. It's enormous. It takes a lot more energy for a female to make a bird egg than it would for the male to make the sperm. And in mammals, the females put in a lot more energy, right, for their eggs and to grow their young. And then we can take an extreme example, like the kiwi. This is a small ground-dwelling bird in New Zealand. I think you probably know what they look like, but a kiwi's egg is like 20% of her weight, of her size. That's huge. That's huge. I mean, that's like if you weighed 150 pounds, you would give birth to a 30-pound baby. That's enormous. We don't. We give birth to like 8-pound babies, more like 5% of our body weight, give or take. So the idea here is that females spend a lot more energy investing into the eggs and investing into the offspring than the males. So that's why we think that males are often more ornamented. And of course, you know, they're ornamented to attract mates. The females, especially in birds, are less ornamented. And we think that sometimes has to do with being more cryptic. They're trying to blend in. Once again, Our good examples are birds. Female birds often blend in much more than a male bird. Now, another reason why you might see some sexual dimorphism. Di just means two, morph means like shape. So the idea of a dimorphic species is you've got males and females that look differently. Another reason for that could be good genes. Let's return to our peacock example. Just think of those beautiful feathers, that enormous tail. Okay, first of all, you're a male. You're wandering around in the forest and you're brightly colored. Well, that means several different things. One is you've got good genes and you're advertising your good genes to the world. Not only do you have the genes to make you colorful and bright, you are healthy. You're avoiding parasites. You're avoiding disease. You're also not getting eaten. I often find it pretty amazing that some of these brightly colored birds can avoid predation while being brightly colored. Now, there's always a trade-off, right? If you get too brightly colored and too big and extravagant, you are more easily picked off. So in this case, a natural selection kind of can pump the brakes a little bit on sexual selection. And in fact, one of the progenitors of the modern synthesis, a guy named Ronald Fisher, the same Ronald Fisher that's famous for statistics, he proposed this idea of a Fisherian runaway, that basically you could have sexual selection create some crazy stuff. And this would account for like the exaggerated male ornamentation we see. Once again, think of a peacock, right? The idea is that it's a positive feedback. The female continually chooses the males with more and more colorful ornamentation, a longer tail, or some other feature that may not help that male survive, but it does help it attract mates. And like I said, we think this can happen very quickly, and it can also cause rapid speciation. And like I said, this Fisherian runaway probably does get checked by natural selection. If your tail gets too big, you can't fly. If you're too colorful, you might get easily picked off by a predator. If you become too extravagant, you may not be able to feed very well. And in fact, our peacocks, that enormous tail, well, some of those feathers look like eyes. So you can imagine you're a fox in the forest and you're sneaking up on this bird, right? It's so brightly colored, it's so gangly looking. You're like, this is gonna be an easy meal, right? Then all of a sudden you go to pounce on it, it sees you, and then it flashes this enormous tail, and this bird like triples, quadruples in size. You're probably gonna stop dead in your tracks and run off. Or you're an owl, you're sitting there watching it. The bird sees you, opens up its tail, and you see all these eyes. The peacock might not even see you, but you don't know that because you see this tail where all the feathers look like eyes. So you think it sees you, and you're like, well, it sees me. I'm not going to bother with that. And yes, birds actually do signaling to show the predator, I see you. If you see me, you're unlikely to catch me. The blue-crowned motmot does that in Central America. And you know, ironically, I think in human culture, every now and then we get a Fisherian runaway. I'm a child of the 80s. Well, I was born in the 70s, but you know, I became kind of sentient, I guess, in the 1980s, back when the hair bands were doing their thing. If you've ever seen the pictures from like around 1986 of Poison and Cinderella and Motley Crue and Twisted Sister and Bon Jovi, yeah, that hairband metal, that's probably a good example of Fisherian runaway in fashion. And that kind of ended in 1991 when Nirvana came out with Smells Like Teen Spirit. They went back to blue jeans, t-shirts, and plaid shirts. All became the rage. But it kind of ended that metal hairband look of the 1980s. So it's kind of hard to do this in a podcast, but I'm going to give it a shot anyways. And I'm going to try to give you some examples of sexual selection that doesn't involve a peacock. So we got to use our imaginations a little bit, or you can hop on your phone or your computer and do a little Googling while listening to this. But let's talk about some sexual selection here. Let's talk about some male ornamentation. Let's start with reptiles. There's a group of lizards called anoles, A-N-O-L-E-S. And in fact, my friend at University of New Mexico, Dr. Steve Poe, he's one of the world experts on these anoleless lizards. That's why I know so much about them, because I've gone all over Central and South America looking for these lizards with them. But they're famous for having this colorful flap of skin underneath their chin, and that's called a dewlap. And they'll flash out this dewlap to attract mates or to hold their territory. And according to Dr. Poe, you can actually tell which species of anole you have based on the color of the dewlap. And then, in South America, in Ecuador, is one of the most famous anoles, which he rediscovered in 2009, and I was lucky enough to be there and photograph it. And this is Anolis proboscis. Some people call it the Pinocchio anole. And the male has this long flap of skin coming out from its nose. And this species was thought to be extinct because it hadn't been seen since the 1950s. And we went in 2009 and found 5 individuals, I think, in almost one night. And the females, they don't have that long skin flap. So we know that's a sexually selected trait. There's also sexual selection in fish as well. In North America, in our streams, especially in the east, we have these small, colorful fish called a darter. And it's actually the males that are brightly colored. And you might have a color pattern on a fin that goes something like red, blue, and green. The next species over might just have red. The next species over might have blue and red. And the idea is that the females are selecting these fish based on the colors of their fins. In mammals, we also see sexual selection. We see lions with the large manes. Elk will grow antlers so they can attract females and also fight other males. Okay, now I gotta return back to birds. I'm a birder, I know. I like going out and looking at birds. I also watch them in my backyard. They're so fun to watch. You know, sexual selection in birds, we commonly see the males that are brightly colored, and that's the first thing that comes to mind. But it's more than that. Think about the northern mockingbird. The males and females are almost identical looking, and in fact, I've never been able to tell a male from a female just by looking at them. But the males sing. And the males sing, and as they grow older, they hear more and more sounds in their environment, and they sing more and more complex songs. So in this case, the female is selecting the male northern mockingbird based on the complexity of his song. That's not the only thing females like in birds. There's also a bird called a lesser prairie chicken. There's also greater prairie chickens. There's also sage grouse. Now here's what happens. The males all come together in the spring, and it's called a lek. And what they do is they sing and they dance. I know they put on quite the show for the females, and they show off all their feathers. Now, they would probably look pretty wild if we removed all the coyotes and hawks and everything that eats these prairie chickens. But they sing and they dance, and the females are clearly choosing the males that have the neatest dance, the most intricate feathers, and the best songs. I'm not sure what she's choosing, but they're choosing something there. In Central America, there are these birds called the mannequin bird. And the mannequin bird will clap its wings and do a moonwalk dance on the limb. It's quite astounding. And one more. In the West, there is a bird called the Western grebe. Now, the males and females, once again, look fairly similar to each other. You probably can't even tell them apart. And the way that the female chooses the male is that he has to be able to dance with her. So they will start mimicking each other's movements. And then in their final show, they will literally get up and run across the water, flapping their wings. And the male has to be able to do this with the female. So there you go. You know, in female birds, it can become quite varied. It's not just about looking like a peacock. It's, can you sing? Can you dance? Can you dance with me? Can you sing and dance and look nice? So all of these things come together in birds, which I think is very interesting. It's one of the cool reasons why I like to watch them. Okay, so almost every example I have given has been an example of female choice, where the females are choosing males based on some trait. A song, a dance. Can you dance with me? How good is your song? How intricate is your song? How pretty are your feathers? That's female choice. Females are choosing the males. There is also male choice, where the males actually select for traits on the females. And in nature, this is actually rare. We don't see that very often, except with one species, and that is humans. And in humans, our females have traits that we believe are male sexually selected. And these are waist to hip ratios, adipose tissue around the mammary glands, because you don't need the adipose tissue to produce milk, but yet it's there. So these are different features that were probably selected for by males. All right. Well, there you have it. These are the examples of natural selection, including sexual selection, where you want to place that, that can cause adaptive evolution. And the sexual selection, that's, like I said, a little weird. And like I said, sexual selection can be a bit difficult to classify. Most people put it in with natural selection because it improves your fitness, your ability to reproduce and pass on the traits to your next generation. That's why it's considered natural selection, but it might not be adaptive in terms of surviving in the environment. Now, in my next podcast, I will talk about non-adaptive evolution. Wait, yes, you can actually have evolution where the population is not actually adapting to the environment. You can have evolution without natural selection. We'll talk about that next. Well, this has been another episode of Tom SciCast.